Welcome to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Scott Rodd. Ready or not, Election Day is nearly here. We take one final look at some local races, including one that could determine the balance of power for the San Diego County Board of Supervisors.
Right now, the Democrats have a 3-2 majority on the County Board of Supervisors, and this, if the challenger, Kevin Faulkner, were to win, that would switch. But it's much more than that.
We also discuss how state and local housing laws are giving homeowners more options to sell or develop their land. Plus, we hear about other stories from the week on the Roundup. That's ahead on KPBS Roundtable. Well, after the primaries and debates and candidate changes and mountains of campaign mailers, Election Day is nearly here. Voters can cast their ballot by mail, at a drop box, or in person at a voting center or polling place up until Tuesday at 8 p.m. when polls close in San Diego County. And a reminder, as long as you're in line by 8 p.m., you're set. You can cast your ballot. And if you haven't registered to vote yet, there is same-day voter registration available at voting centers. Okay, so here to talk about the election as the finish line nears is Scott Lewis. He is editor-in-chief of Voice of San Diego, which is part of the Public Matters Initiative with KPBS and iNewsSource. Scott, welcome to Roundtable.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Among the many local races on this year's ballot in San Diego County, one race that is getting a lot of attention is the County Board of Supervisors race in District 3 between Democratic incumbent Tara Lawson-Reamer and former San Diego Mayor, Republican Kevin Faulkner. What's at stake in this race?
I think that what everybody speaks about is the control of the Board of Supervisors. It's a nonpartisan race, but obviously parties have a big role. And they do sort of coalition as parties. And right now, the Democrats have a 3-2 majority on the County Board of Supervisors. And this, if the challenger, Kevin Faulkner, were to win, that would switch. But it's much more than that. I think at stake are housing issues, for example. Kevin Faulkner wants to see the county make good on its general plan for where homes can be built throughout the county. And Tara Lawson-Reamer and the other Democratic county supervisors want to see homes concentrated in urban areas instead. And that kind of thing, that could make a difference for hundreds and hundreds of housing units out there. An approach to homelessness, Kevin Faulkner says he can force the county to treat it as the emergency it deserves and really rally them to centralize the region's approach to homelessness under his leadership. And I think that really calls the question of whether he is the kind of leader that can make a massive organization like that change its priorities and its approach to this issue. And I think it's a big question on her part. She says, look, it's an issue we're making steady progress on. You shouldn't derail it now. And so a lot of things like that at stake. It's just the priorities, spending, relationship with labor are all at stake there.
This race has started to get a little contentious. What claims have the two candidates made about each other? And have there been any surprising developments here in the home stretch?
Yeah, so there's basically on the one side, Kevin Faulkner, when you're running to ask an incumbent, you got to prove that they should lose their job and that you should be the one to replace them. And the proof that she should lose her job has been concentrated into a claim that she doesn't attend meetings that she should attend, that she misses work. In particular about a regional task force for the homelessness, they say, she's missed those. She'll say, look, I send a staffer there. That's all they told me they needed to do. He or she briefs me and we're able to keep on top of those priorities so I can do other things at the same time. That attack, not showing up to work, is one of those sort of really powerful things that can sometimes, be a qualifier or disqualifier in voters' minds. But, millions of dollars have come to support him and to send those kinds of attacks and also pump his name recognition and support up. But all she's had to do and a smaller amount of money has gone to support her campaign. But it has all been concentrated on connecting him to Donald Trump. This district will be overwhelmingly supportive of Kamala Harris in the election. And he's been really trying to make the case, and his supporters, is spending independently, have tried to make the case that he's a, you can vote for Kamala and then you can vote for Kevin, that he's a more liberal or centrist Republican. But she's got, you know, that picture of him standing with Trump, and he hasn't, he's refused so far to withdraw his support for Trump that he's sort of reiterated over the years. And that's been a brutal attack. And it'll be a really interesting test to see if that still is as potent of an attack in these sort of Democratic leaning districts as it has been in the past. But if it is, then the millions of dollars are really going to have trouble overcoming it.
Yeah, I was going to say that photo with Faulkner and Trump, Tara Lawson Reamer's campaign has definitely made hay from that photo.
It's ubiquitous, yeah.
Yeah. All right, coming down to the wire here, does any one candidate appear to have an edge from your perspective?
No, I think, you know, as an incumbent, the makeup of the district, you'd have to assume Tara Lawson Reamer still has kind of an upper hand. But again, just millions of dollars from builders, from restaurants, from contractors who are opposed to sort of union agreements for building big projects. They've all lined up to support Kevin Faulkner. They really see this as one of the biggest races in California, including among some of the Congress contests out there, congressional contests. So that money matters and it can make a difference. So the physics might be there for her, but he's doing everything he can and has as many resources as needed to make a change.
Let's switch gears to Assembly District 75. This district it's a massive district. It covers most of East San Diego County and stretches up north as well. It includes a 50-mile stretch of the U.S.-Mexico border. This race has been pretty wild from the start. Who are the two candidates facing off in this district?
It's a Republican-leaning district. Marie Waldron is leaving it. And so the race to replace her is two Republicans. Carl DeMaio, well known as a former city councilman, talk radio host, and just, you know, a real sort of populist type figure. He's good at firing people up and getting them upset about different issues in the region, taxes, stuff like that. He's running against Andrew Hayes, a Republican school board member in Lakeside, who also has worked closely with Senator Brian Jones. This is a really interesting test because Republican Party has lined up with Hayes and is spending on his behalf. The Democrats, Lorena Gonzalez, labor leaders, police, fire, the apartment group, the realtors, DoorDash, they've all lined up against Carl DeMaio and for Andrew Hayes. So it's a really interesting test of, like, can this very diverse, passionate coalition that's come out against Carl DeMaio beat him? Or does Carl DeMaio have the kind of populist support that's going to withstand that? Because they really want to end his political career. He's been such a firebrand and problem and just annoyance for them for so long that they'd like to see this be the end of his political ambitions. On the other hand, if he wins, he could have a platform unlike anything he's had before on a state level. And so they feel like a lot's at stake here, and he's raised a lot of money. So this is a really interesting race, even though it's two Republicans.
Yeah, just this week, there was an unusual press conference where top Democratic and Republican political figures here in the region got together, all with one unifying message, which was basically, don't vote for Carl DeMaio. You know, in our day and age, finding it's so politically divisive, this seemed to be one thing that these folks could get behind, which was sort of interesting. You know, as you mentioned, Carl DeMaio has some serious name recognition in the region. He's a well-known figure, a bit of a firebrand, but he only held political office once as a San Diego City councilman, and that was over a decade ago. He's run for several other offices, but he hasn't won those races. So how do you explain his staying power?
He's a master at sort of raising the profile of an issue, framing it in a way that gets people fired up, identifying, you know, an obscure proposal for a tax and making a big deal out of it. We did a story about how he collects signatures for petitions, like maybe one that he's tried to do several times to raise a requirement on the ballot for voter ID in the future. He's put that up several times, never actually qualified for the ballot, but every time he gets a signature, he gets a new contact. He can email them with his next cause and his next plea for money. His organization, Reform California, has been accused of using all that money for promotion of himself and causes unrelated to the thing that he was raising money for. And the police officers have used that to file a formal complaint to try to, you know, derail him. The amount of acrimony toward him is really something, but it's balanced again by this sort of one-to-one connection he has with all of these individual donors and volunteers that he's fired up for so many years going forward. And yeah, again, it's a test of whether that can withstand the institutional acrimony from the Republican Party, from a lot of Republicans, the Congressman Daryl Issa, Brian Jones, Joel Anderson, the county supervisor. They've all lined up against him, and it's just incredible to see.
Absolutely. Let's switch gears to the San Diego mayor's race, which has gotten a lot more interesting in the last month or so. Independent Larry Turner is running against Mayor Todd Gloria. He's the Democratic incumbent. What do the latest polls show?
Well, there's been there was a UT poll that showed Todd Gloria kind of widening the gap as the incumbent, but there's a lot of undecideds. The big question is, if those undecideds, you know, are they gonna go with what they know with Todd Gloria, or are they gonna take a chance on this independent? And again, Larry Turner's in a similar situation that Kevin Faulkner's in. He's really trying to prove to Democrats that he's a viable choice for them. He sent out, or his supporters sent out a text saying he's a pro-choice independent and challenging voters not to be sheep, quote sheep, you know, and go along with just the Democratic choices, but to consider a different option like him because the city's in such bad shape, they say. So that's a big challenge. Again, you got to prove that the incumbent deserves to lose their job and that you're the one that deserves to get it. And that means just getting your name out there a lot. So these independent spending, this about $1.5 million has come in independently to support him from just, you know, one supporter in Point Loma that just wanted to balance the field and give Todd Gloria a run for his money. So I think it's a definitely more interesting race than it was shaping up to be. It's, you know, every hour that goes by is an hour that Todd Gloria banks as the incumbent and gets some votes in that probably lean his way, at least for now. So we'll see if they can overcome that.
You mentioned all this money that's been poured into this race that's, you know, backing Larry Turner. Where's it coming from? And has there been an explanation as to why there's just been so much investment from this one person into this race?
You know, I called him and he wasn't interested in talking with me. He issued a statement to La Prensa.
And who was the contributor?
His name's Steven Richter. He hasn't been known to make political donations in the past. Again, $1.5 million he's put through the Lincoln Club to support Larry Turner. And he wasn't interested in talking to me. He said in his statement to La Prensa that he just wanted to balance things, you know, all the developers and sort of entrenched interests that support Todd Gloria. He wanted to balance it out and give him a run and force him to be accountable. And it's kind of interesting to watch. He says he's a Democrat, or he was a Democrat. He supports Kamala Harris for president, but he just obviously has a real frustration. And there's a lot of frustration around the city about the homeless crisis, the cost of living, and several other, you know, really big crises that are hard to make progress on from the mayor's point of view. But that might be part of the point. Larry Turner and his supporters think that it's time for a new, more urgent team of leadership in there. And obviously this supporter in Point Loma is all on board. There might be even more money coming from what I hear.
Interesting. How has Gloria responded? And have there been any changes in their campaign tactics?
Well, he doesn't take anything for granted. He's kind of notorious for seeing threats, and his supporters have come together and raised nearly $1 million themselves, again, from a lot of these kind of core institutional supporters of the way things. And there's a kind of well-known guy in San Diego, deal maker, former port commissioner, Steve Cushman, developer, former car dealer. He's raised a ton of money for the mayor, and they're really trying to balance out that attack. So the real question is, will the ads against Todd Gloria start to really hit him hard, because again, they really have to prove that he's not the one you want to be mayor going forward. And I'm not sure that's been done quite yet. We'll see.
Finally, there's a trend that's happening at major newspapers across the country. The LA Times, Washington Post, USA Today, along with its network of hundreds of local papers, they're declining to endorse presidential candidates. You're editor-in-chief of a local news outlet, so give me your two cents on this. Just, I'm curious, as a leader of a local news outlet, what's your perspective?
Yeah, well, as a nonprofit, we wouldn't and can't endorse candidates or oppose them. I think that, though, it's just really, it's hard for a newspaper to do two things at once, and that is to endorse and take a side on an election and market how good your analysis of it is and your endorsement or opposition is, and also market that you are a neutral observer of the election. And I think there's you know, these sides that newspapers have. The news team will insist, like, we're neutral, we're not part of the endorsement process. And then, and yet, like, that distinction is something that the public has never quite grasped. And I think that if you want to make a principled decision that we're not going to endorse, we're just going to have a newspaper dedicated to neutrality and observation and investigation, that's fine, but you probably should do that before, like, long before, the week before the election maybe. And that's probably you know, and really lay out a principled vision for it. Otherwise it looks like a panic at the end when something got hard, and you never want to look like you're panicking. So, but I do think newspapers have this cognitive dissonance that they've never really managed well, which is this, you know, this commitment to neutrality, to telling the story as it is, and then this other side of their shop that literally hopes for and advocates for a certain outcome to these elections. And that's just a dissonance that's really hard to reconcile. And I think you're seeing the pain of it being reconciled now. Is like, you know, whenever somebody sits with cognitive dissonance, they have to, it's almost painful. They have to fix it. And the way that Jeff Bezos did is maybe not the most productive at the Washington Post. And it certainly hurt his business in the short term, but probably could have done that longer in advance and maybe saved some of the pain of it.
Yeah, the timing definitely curious, conspicuous. They've lost now at last tally about 250,000 subscribers, digital subscribers, which is like 10% of the number of subscribers they have. So a big hit in the short term. So we'll see how that plays out in the long term. I've been speaking with Scott Lewis, editor-in-chief of Voice of San Diego, as well as a KPBS partner on the ongoing Public Matters Project. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Scott. That's great. And we'll all hold on for next week, huh?
Yeah. Hang on to your butts. When Roundtable returns, we hear about recent laws meant to spur more housing production and housing density in San Diego.
Well, the hope from experts is that this will lead to more entrepreneurship, more competition, particularly among small businesses getting back into the home building industry.
That's ahead on Roundtable. You're listening to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Scott Rodd. Concern over the high cost of housing and its availability is top of mind for voters here in San Diego and beyond. KPBS Metro reporter Andrew Bowen recently looked into the impact of some recent housing laws enacted by the state legislature aimed at increasing housing production. And he joins me now to talk about it. Andrew, welcome back to Roundtable.
Thanks, Scott.
So let's start with Senate Bill 9. Tell us about it. What is Senate Bill 9?
Senate Bill 9 was passed in 2021, went into effect in 2022, and it allows at least one duplex on almost every lot in California that is zoned for housing, even if the zoning restricts, would otherwise restrict that lot to one single detached house. So, and in addition to that, depending on the size of the lot, the shape of the lot, you can also split it in two and build a duplex on each of those two parcels. So, in effect, you can take one property. Currently, you can only build one house there under the zoning. SB9 allows you to build up to four. So it was an effort by the state legislature to increase the housing supply, as you mentioned, and experts agree that's really key to lowering costs. And it was seen as a really big political achievement because it takes on single-family zoning, which has been kind of a third rail in California politics for decades. 80% of the land in San Diego that is zoned for housing is zoned for single-family housing. So this is very low density, and it's an effort to kind of build housing not just in those areas that already allow apartments and condos, but also in these neighborhoods that have pretty much stayed the same for the past half century.
Well, as you said, this law has now been around for a couple of years. It's taken some time to ramp up. How are San Diego residents taking advantage of it?
Well, not many are. That was one conclusion that I made while reporting on this. But I did find one homeowner in North Park who is making use of SB9. His name's Jay Blake, and he bought his house with his wife in 2018. And the house is set back pretty far from the street, so he has this really large front yard. And he didn't have any use for it. In fact, he actually had to spend $5,000 on, maintaining the landscaping. He saw this land as more of a liability for him than an asset. And so he thought, why not put this land to better use?
I had people come out to give me quotes on it. I realized that I didn't necessarily have the resources to do that on my own. And so I did a lot of Google searching about the possibility of other things that I could do with it.
Folks like Jay Blake aren't taking on these projects on their own. Tell me about some of the companies that are helping residents take advantage of SB9.
As you heard from Jay just now, he was not ready to take on a project this complex and something that requires this much investment. So, you know, when you build housing, it takes hundreds of thousands of dollars in capital. And he, as a regular homeowner, he's a nurse practitioner. He just doesn't have that cash, you know, sitting in the bank. Splitting the lot allows a homeowner to essentially cash out on land that they don't need. And so what in those Google searches that he did, he came across this company called Build Casa. And Build Casa signed a contract with Jay Blake, and that sets the purchase price for this land, which, by the way, was $250,000. I was surprised by that. He was surprised by that. He had no idea that his front yard that had been costing him money could be worth just that much money. So he was pretty blown away and very pleasantly surprised, as you can imagine. Build Casa, under the contract, has up to 18 months to actually officially split this lot, create a new parcel that can be owned by somebody else. And at that point, they can execute the transaction, purchase that lot, and then once they own the land, they either sell it to a developer or they partner with a local contractor to build a duplex, you know, on their own. So, this business model is essentially homeowners get to outsource the complexities of the permitting process to a company like Build Casa. Build Casa partners with the builders to actually build the housing, and, you know, everybody comes out a little bit wealthier in the end.
Right. And as you said, this would apply to many areas of San Diego. Of course, homeowners have to have the right type of property, the right amount of land, right, to split their property and do this. But I'm sure it'd be a surprise for many homeowners that this may be an option for them. How many homes in the region are we talking about in terms of that are taking advantage of Senate Bill 9? And is there a forecast of how many more could utilize this law in the coming years?
I asked the city of San Diego for data on permits issued under SB9, also applications. They told me by my deadline, at least, they couldn't get me the numbers for 2024. But they had already put together the numbers for 2022 and 23, and that's the first 2 years that SB9 was in effect. And in those 2 years, they received 13 applications for lot splits. By the end of 2023, zero of those had been approved. They told me likely some of these homeowners applied for a lot split but didn't realize that they weren't actually eligible because of maybe some of the constraints of the property. So no lot splits have occurred in San Diego, at least as of the end of last year. And they also received 20 applications for new units. So this would be, you know, you have a vacant lot and you can build a duplex instead of a single family home. Or if you have a single family home, you can also convert it into a duplex, but with an addition. So, you know, not a lot of, and I should mention, of those 20 applications for new units, only two had been approved. So not a lot of new housing coming through this law. But it is still very new. Homeowners are still figuring out what their rights are under the law. Companies like BuildCasa, and there's actually a competitor called Yardsworth, are still figuring out their own business models and how to navigate this whole process. So it's really hard at this point to say how many units could be produced in San Diego under SB9 because our data set is just too small.
How does San Diego's ADU bonus program fit into this picture?
So a couple years before SB9 was passed, the legislature passed a different law that allows an accessory dwelling unit on every single family lot. And, you know, this would be a backyard cottage, or maybe a converting a garage into a living space. And after that law was passed at the state level, San Diego took it even further, and they allowed homeowners to build a bonus ADU if they also restrict one of their ADUs as affordable housing. So you build one ADU, you get an extra one, you know, depending on how many units you designate as affordable housing, you can build a whole lot more housing than would otherwise be allowed. When you're within walking distance of a public transit stop, there is no limit on the number of ADUs. So you could theoretically build 10 or 15 or 16, accessory dwelling units. At that point, you're really just talking about a small apartment building. And this has been very popular in San Diego. It's actually been held up by other cities that are trying to, you know, build more housing as an example of what is possible in California, because, you know, there is a lot of demand for housing and it's not getting built because there are a lot of restrictions on it. So it's pretty wildly successful in San Diego if your measure of success is building more housing. And if SB9 has been slow to take off in San Diego, one of the reasons could be that we just simply have a very generous ADU bonus program, and that's where all of this demand for infill housing in single-family neighborhoods is going. That being said, you cannot sell an ADU separately from your house currently under the current law. So if a homeowner wants to cash out on their land, SB9 is currently their only option for that.
Interesting. So they are complementary in certain ways or thematically, but there are certain distinctions between them that are important to keep in mind. If more and more people take advantage of SB9 and similar laws, what impacts could that have on the home building industry?
Well, the hope from experts is that this will lead to more entrepreneurship, more competition, particularly among small businesses getting back into the home building industry. So after the Great Recession, we saw a lot of consolidation in the building industry. You have these really big national builders like Lennar Homes, Graystar. Those companies got even bigger. And then a lot of these smaller scale builders basically either went out of business or they changed their business altogether and no longer build housing. Many of them switched to home flipping. So, buying an old dilapidated house, renovating the interior, and then selling it for a profit. There's, I think, always going to be a role for home flipping, but one of the downsides to it is that it does drive up the price of housing. And so if those folks who are currently focused on flipping homes, you know, increasing the price of housing, if some of those get back into the business of actually building more housing, the hope is that, you know, these laws allowing ADUs and duplexes and everything will create more competition for those really big national builders, those mega builders, and ultimately increase the supply of housing and put a downward pressure on prices.
Has there been any pushback or controversy around Senate Bill 9?
A huge amount of pushback and a huge amount of controversy, absolutely, particularly from homeowners who have lived in their homes for quite a while, who thought that they bought into a neighborhood that is restricted to low-density housing and single-family homes and where none of that new housing is going to get built. There are some cases in San Diego, particularly with the ADU bonus program, where you have multi-story structures going up in somebody's backyard, and then the property owner next door or behind, you know, that maybe they share a backyard, like divided by a fence, suddenly they've got windows now that can see into their backyard. So if, you know, your concern is privacy and tranquility, then it's understandable why somebody would be, you know, upset by these larger ADU projects going into single-family neighborhoods. Now, to supporters of the program and to folks who are really struggling to afford housing in this very expensive market in San Diego, just having a backyard at all seems like a luxury. And the privacy concerns or the aesthetic concerns of homeowners are just simply don't trump the need for more housing. And the need to integrate these very high opportunity, high income neighborhoods with very expensive housing with more lower cost housing. You know, a single family home pretty much 10 times out of 10 is going to be more expensive to buy or rent than an ADU in somebody's backyard.
This law was part of a housing package that also included SB 10, which has also gotten pushback from folks in San Diego and in many places around California. What does that law, SB 10, aim to do, and how is it different from SB 9?
The biggest difference is that SB 9 imposes new requirements on cities, whereas SB 10 gives the cities more options, and it allows them to opt into a program. So SB 10 basically allows a city or a county, any local jurisdiction, to quickly and easily rezone properties for up to 10 units without having to go through a very long and legally fraught process of an environmental impact report. So Mayor Todd Gloria took this law, SB 10, brought forward a version of it to the city's planning commission, and it died very quickly, actually. The planning commission voted it down. They seemed to just not like this idea of quickly upzoning single-family neighborhoods. They think that the process should go slowly and that there should be this longer review process. That's kind of in conflict with, you know, what we know about the housing crisis, which is that it's been building for a really long time. And there should be, I think, a sense of urgency in actually solving this problem. But because SB 10 is an opt-in bill, unlike SB 9, which is a preemption bill, SB 10 really hasn't had any impact, I would say, on the supply of housing in California at all.
The biggest impact in San Diego is probably just all the signs around that you see that say no on SB 10,
exactly,
even though it doesn't apply here.
It did have a big political impact, I will say that. It got the opponents to this type of housing very organized.
Yes, certainly. Briefly, switching gears a little bit, but sticking to housing, this week, San Diego City Council President Sean Elo Rivera announced that the city council is looking into a ban on the use of certain types of software for landlords in setting rental prices. Now, can you explain more about what's going on with these tools and how the city council is hoping to regulate them?
I would start this story in 2022 when ProPublica published an investigation into this company called RealPage, which gathers private data from the housing market on rental housing. They feed it through this algorithm that they've developed, and that algorithm spits out a number that tells a landlord how much they should charge for rent. So this story had a really big impact. It touches on these fears of artificial intelligence, these fears of these frustrations that many people have with the housing market that is just too expensive. And in August, the Department of Justice actually sued RealPage and essentially argues that this software is modern-day price fixing and that it violates antitrust laws. Landlords are supposed to be competing with each other for business, and when an algorithm allows them to collude and fix prices, they say, you know, the argument is that this is against the law. San Francisco banned this type of algorithm or software that sets rental prices in September, and the proposal from Council President Elo Rivera is that San Diego should do the same. We haven't seen the ordinance itself, so there are a lot of details still to be worked out. All that the Rules Committee, the City Council's Rules Committee, discussed this week was the broader framework, which will be brought forward to the full City Council at a future date.
Well, something we'll definitely be keeping an eye on. I've been speaking with Andrew Bowen, KPBS Metro reporter. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
Up next, we check in on some other stories we've been following on the weekly roundup. That's next on Roundtable. You're listening to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Scott Rodd. It's time for our weekly roundup, where we catch up on some other stories we've been following. Joining me now is KPBS producer Andrew Bracken. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Scott. How's it going?
Not too bad. Not too bad. I'm going to start things off with actually a light story that caught my eye. I don't know. Maybe light isn't the right word, but there's an incident up in Santa Clara County. There's a candidate for assembly that's running up there, and there is an egging incident from years ago that has surfaced in this race, and it's become a little bit of a controversy. And it jumped out to me just because, you know, this happened like 5 years ago, and back, you know, 5-10 years ago, this might have been something that was like, whoa, I can't believe a candidate threw eggs at someone's house. But now it just seems so quaint in our political world. So I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, in the article, I think there's a picture of the candidate. I think they have like sunglasses on and they're throwing the egg. And it, you're right, there is sort of like an innocence or like a simplicity to it that we're laughing about it, but kind of sadly it doesn't exist today. I know a lot of people, I've seen a lot of stories about people kind of struggling with just how to manage the anxiety that's coming with the election and the uncertainty, a lot of the rhetoric and the divisiveness, right? And this kind of points to a different time.
Yeah.
And not that long ago still, right? Like 5 years ago.
For sure, for sure. And it should be said that the person whose car and house was egged, you know, they actually knew the candidate. They settled their differences and they said, like, you know, they're on good footing. It's okay. And, you know, we are laughing about this. I should say I am not pro-egging.
No.
It is egging season, you know, around Halloween. So I am not pro-egging. But I will say that, you know, this is just the type of kind of political controversy that, you know, we were more used to years ago, but now we have things like ballot boxes being set on fire, racist rants at arenas, and, you know, people storming the Capitol. So anyways, it caught my eye, thought I'd mention it. But how about you? What's something that got your attention this week?
Moving away from the election here for a second, the Union Tribune's Philip Molnar published a piece about the problems that Comic-Con had. It was their open registration day last Saturday, and it just got overwhelmed, so it kind of caused a lot of frustration with folks looking to get signed up, get their tickets going. And they basically had to cancel it, you know, about a half hour after starting it because it just kind of shut down. And I know, you know, we hear about these sort of ticket meltdowns or Ticketmaster shutdowns, things like that. They haven't announced when they will open that registration again. Hopefully next time they'll get all the bugs out of it. I think they called it a unforeseen anomaly with the website, but I think it just crashed from too many people getting on there.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's sort of a victim of its own success, right? So many people want to go to this. But at the same time, right, this is a signature event for the region. And to see this happen is surprising, kind of a blemish on it. But, you know, hopefully things sort out for people just being able to register and things will go smoothly from here.
Yeah, and I guess this is something that means a lot to a lot of people. And so I can just, I just relate to that sort of frustration of folks. I mean, I definitely know people that it means a lot to their year to kind of get tickets and to attend this and to like have that, because they were getting like false messages of, oh, you have a ticket. No, you don't, you know, that kind of thing. So I think it caused some stress.
Absolutely. I'm going to turn to a different story, this one on homelessness and homelessness funding. The Newsom administration announced $830 million in new homelessness spending, but there's some strings attached to it. And this money is being divvied up to different cities and counties, but it comes with certain requirements for transparency and tracking as to how this money is being spent, but also the outcomes of this money. And part of this was related to an audit released earlier this year that found that cities, specifically San Jose and San Diego, weren't doing enough to track just how this money was being spent and the impacts that it was having. They weren't measuring it at least up to what the state wanted to see. So I thought it was interesting that this sort of follow-up expenditure on homelessness was coming with certain requirements, and especially coming from an audit that looked at San Diego specifically.
Yeah, and I think this brought me back to the reporting from CalMatters, Marisa Kendall, who we've had on the show a couple of times talking about her reporting. She looked into the audit and some of the spending. I think the state's spent upwards, you know, of $20+ billion on homelessness. And this audit kind of brought up a lot, like, how effective is the spending? How is it being tracked? And you're right, San Diego was definitely a part of that. So it sort of seems like a predictable response to kind of the fallout that kind of came from what came out of that audit.
And also just kind of like the least, frankly, that I think people
lowest
would expect.
Bar possible.
Yeah, this is a tremendous amount of money we're talking about. And yet, you know, as many voters will say, this is top of mind. This issue of homelessness is top of mind. They're seeing the problem get worse. So having some accountability attached to these dollars, I think, makes sense. Speaking of Newsom, he was also down in the South Bay looking at the pollution crisis that's going on at the Tijuana River Valley. What's going on there?
Yes, we had Mackenzie Elmer from Voice of San Diego on the program a couple of weeks ago talking about the ongoing issues there. There's kind of a push to get emergency declarations, to get more money, to make it more of a priority. So Governor Gavin Newsom came down, visited, did kind of a press conference and kind of updating what's happening with the international wastewater treatment plant that's at issue of some of the problems down there. But still no emergency declaration from the state, and I still think there are a lot of questions of where it goes from here. And like I said, a lot of kind of legislation and political wrangling there.
And this was Newsom's first visit down to the wastewater treatment plant. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think he's been here yet. So we'll see if it's a sign of coming action, like I said.
It's kind of surprising because there's been, you know, a swelling outcry over this crisis and so many people in the community saying, look, we need to do something. We need this to be addressed. And there have been folks who have specifically targeted that message at Newsom. And I was just surprised to see, yeah, that it was his first time down there. To wrap it up, I guess, on the Halloween sort of theme, the story in the New York Times caught my eye because it was just so wild. And as I read it, the more I read, it was almost like I couldn't believe it. Apparently, crows can hold grudges. The birds, crows can hold grudges for years and years. Sometimes if they perceive that someone has slighted them, harmed them, poses some sort of danger to them and their flock, or murder, as they're called for crows, they will swoop down and target and pester and annoy and even attack people. And this can go on for years and years. And I was amazed reading this. And of course, crows are very intelligent birds, and they apparently use that intelligence at times to hold a grudge.
Right. And this is a really interesting story. Crows get a lot of bad press, I would say. And just that, you know, you explained there, it's not a flock of crows. It's a murder of crows. And, you know, I love crows. We have crows in our backyard. They definitely probably have a grudge against my dog, I feel like. But also this story did kind of also put out the point. They may hold grudges, but they may not be able to apply that grudge to the right person. It seems like they get kind of misidentify their targets sometimes because there's some pretty horrifying things. And they do mention, you know, the Hitchcock movie, The Birds, which I still find terrifying. I mean, it's very dated.
Yeah. Yeah. It was sort of still a lasting kitschy horror to Hitchcock's film. The mistaken identity thing was incredible. Just the fact that some sort of unsuspecting person could suddenly become
caught up in it.
Yeah. The target of these crows' ire. I think the one story that stood out to me the most was there was someone who was being targeted. I can't remember if it was truly because they did something against a crow or if it was mistaken identity, but the person started just sort of leaving little bits behind as the crows who were following them, you know, could eat and sort of it turned into this thing where they were bribing the crows almost to leave them alone. And eventually, when one crow came to swoop down and attack or pester the person, the other crows behind them went and sort of shooed that other crow off. And so the person likened it to like a sort of mob bribe or payoff, right, for security. Just incredible. And my, frankly, heart goes out to the people who find themselves on the wrong side of a rivalry with a crow. All right, last question for you. What are you going to do with all the Halloween candy that you've got left over?
You know, just having a conversation about this, I've heard of dentists and other things doing like candy donations, and I've never gotten around to doing it, but I got to see, you know, how to extricate some of it from the kids. They had a lot of candy coming from trick-or-treating, but I need to get it out of the house for my sake as well as theirs. So I don't know. What do you tend to do?
Yeah, I'm going to donate the candy into my mouth. I mean, I crush it. I buy it intending and anticipating that I probably will have a lot left over. I live in a small apartment complex,
yeah.
So I buy the stuff that I love the most. I don't eat a ton of candy, but after Halloween, man, I go on a tear.
I mean, I probably will too. I guess the donation thing is just wishful thinking, so we'll see if I do that.
All right. That'll do it for the roundup this week. Andrew Bracken, thanks and good luck with dealing with all that candy.
Thank you, Scott. You too.
That's our show for today. Thanks for listening. You can listen to KPBS Roundtable anytime as a podcast. Roundtable airs on KPBS FM at noon on Fridays and again Sundays at 6 a.m. If you have any thoughts on today's show or ideas for a future one, you can email us at roundtable@kpbs.org. You can also leave us a message at 619-452-0228. Roundtable's technical producer this week was Brendan Trufa. This show was produced by Andrew Bracken. Brooke Ruth is Roundtable's senior producer, and I'm Scott Rodd. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.